Hello, gang. On Saturday night, I was interviewed by Farron Schoaf, the host of The Alternative Media on the Republic Broadcasting Network. As you may recall, I filled in for him for 3 weeks earlier this year while he was running for Congress. Anyway, we had a great discussion. He asked lots of interesting questions, and hopefully I had some interesting answers. Let's take a listen.
Farron in the studio, the website, thealternativemedia.com. You can email me, thealternativemedia@yahoo.com. And I'm joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. Doctor, how you doing tonight?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me on again.
Oh, glad to have you joining me. And first off, I've got to get your opinion of the revelations, the FBI reopening an investigation into Hillary Clinton. What do you make of it? Do you think this is going to have legs to really undermine her campaign here at the last minute? Or do you think next week maybe they'll, you know, pull the plug and say there was nothing there? I'm just not sure what to make of it. I mean, it's good news. They should be doing this. But what's your thoughts?
Well, I do think it's good news. I mean, there's a lot more reasons than this to really be alarmed at the prospect of a Hillary presidency. You know, there's World War III. That's a pretty big reason. There's the massive replacement level immigration. That's a pretty big reason. There's, you know, enshrining Black Lives Matter as kind of our moral guiding light. That's a big reason to be alarmed. But the email, I mean, what they talk about in terms of the email is, you know, whether or not she was mishandling classified information, which that could involve federal crime. So it's certainly, it's not as if it's not anything. It's something. But I'm very heartened by the fact that at least for the past 24 hours or 36 hours, CNN's been covering it kind of nonstop. And CNN is so much in the tank for Hillary. So that's certainly a good sign. I would like Hillary to be defeated because of, you know, those three big reasons I was talking about. But if she's defeated because of mishandling classified emails, I'll take that. You know, I'll take that. And Farron, you mentioned the possibility of, well, next week they try to pull the plug. And of course that could happen. The media has been so much in the tank for Hillary. The system and the media is a huge part of the system. This electoral system has been so much stacked against Donald Trump. He's got every right to talk about it being rigged. So obviously something's going to come up. They're going to try to do something, you know, some new scandal. But I mean, this was a big hit for Hillary because it almost looked as if Hillary was, you know, getting ready to measure the curtains for the Oval Office again. So I think it's a great thing. But, you know, one last thought about the emails. The real thing about the emails and about the server, the fact that she used a server, what it really indicates is that from day one, from the day that she became Secretary of State, she was planning on doing illegal, corrupt, treasonous things that she needed to hide from people. This is why she had her own server. She didn't use the State Department server because she had things she knew she was going to want to hide because she's just a career criminal. And so that's the big deal. And the big deal with the emails, all these things she's deleted, what has she deleted? Well, she's deleted stuff or tried to delete stuff, tried to hide stuff that would implicate her with really being the godmother of ISIS, the mother of ISIS. She transferred something like $60 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia during her 4 years as Secretary of State at a time when we knew that Saudi Arabia was funding ISIS, and now, of course, the emails show that she knew. Of course she knew. So, yeah, that's my thought on it. I'm very encouraged by it. It's not as if we can celebrate yet, but I'm very encouraged.
And it looks like she was sending these emails perhaps to Huma, and Huma Abedin was sending them to Wiener, their own Wiener's laptop. And that's where the FBI, you know, that's where the story is at right now, which, and here's the thing. This is the thing that gets me about this. I mean, it has come out that she would, that the DNC and her campaign knowingly paying agitators to go to Trump rallies.
Mm-hmm.
No consequences so far. Accepting payments for appointments, pay to play, which is completely illegal, rigging it against Bernie. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it just goes on. Mm-hmm. And on and on. I know we have had some very evil, corrupt politicians before, but we usually, you know, we elect them hoping for the best, and then we find out how corrupt. I don't think in history have we ever, has anyone this corrupt ever been elected to office? Didn't it kind of come out later, like after Bill Clinton got to be president and Whitewater and all of it started unfolding? This is one we know full well in advance of the election that she is a career criminal.
Yeah, you know, and that sounds like it could just be seasonal rhetoric. But no, I think you're absolutely right that who had such a long track record of corruption before their election? You know, Nixon might have been known as Tricky Dick, but what were his big scandals before being elected in 1969? You know, the Checkers speech, he received a puppy.
Hold that thought for me. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. We're coming up on a break, then we'll have a long sec. Back in moments. We're back on the Alternative Media. Farron in the studio. I'm joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. And we were discussing before we went to break, Doctor, that this time, and as you mentioned during the break, we are just a week and a half from the most critical election in my lifetime, maybe ever. But Hillary Clinton, we have got such an exposed, corrupt politician to the core before you were able to even vote for her for president. This is someone that shouldn't even be considered as someone that would have the qualifications because of respectability and not being a criminal to even be running. And yet here we are. She's 10 days away from possibly being the president of the United States. And she advocates all the wrong things. No fly zone in Syria. World War III. Open borders. I mean, I don't think you could have more of a diametric opposites running for office. Your thoughts, Doctor?
No, you're absolutely right. What she's proposing is so much against the interest of the vast majority of Americans, or really pretty much all Americans. It's so much against our interest, but they can shove her down our throat, partly because there's been such effective brainwashing. Brainwashing on two levels. One is people don't really understand what her positions are very well. And two, to the extent that they do understand them, they've been so brainwashed as to what those positions really mean. I went to a Hillary rally this autumn. I stood outside with a sign that said, Hillary equals war, Trump equals peace. And as people walked by, you know, the Hillary people would scratch their heads and look at me with this strange face. And if they, you know, I was just standing there. But if somebody came up to me and engaged me and say, well, what do you mean? And I would talk to them about, you know, the no-fly zone over Syria. I would tell them, do you know who General Joseph Dunford is? He is our top general. He's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Do you know that in September he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee and was asked by one of the senators if the American Air Force could enforce a no-fly zone over Syria. And he says, well, to enforce a no-fly zone over Syria would mean war with Syria and Russia. People don't know anything about this, but you just put together a few facts, and you can see that Hillary's policies mean war with Russia. Now, maybe she thinks that she can just bluff or brinksmanship Putin into submission. It's not going to happen. And why should it happen? And because if you look at the disputes between Russia and the United States is on the wrong side anyway. And it's the United States foreign policy has not been in the interest of the American people. So we shouldn't be supporting our foreign policymakers' policy. We shouldn't be supporting Obama's policy. It's not in our interest in the first place. And then to think that we're going to enforce our policies on Putin, who is a much stronger and more capable leader, no, it's not going to happen.
Well, you know, something I'd mentioned in the first hour, and I've been covering this for the last several weeks, mainstream media, I watch NBC every night, watch the World News with Lester Holt. The 40 million man drill that took place in Russia, where they were doing a nuclear preparedness drill, 40 million people, and some of the statements that Putin has said with regards to, you know, we are moving toward war with the West. None of this is being reported in the mainstream media, and of course the other thing, which I think is kind of almost laughable, how absurd it is that Hillary in the mainstream media keeps going around saying, Russia's hacking the DNC and therefore Donald Trump, and they just constantly demonize Russia. One of the questions I wanted to ask you was, how far do you think we have gone to maybe waking the sleeping giant over there? Because I've wondered this, Doctor, that maybe Putin sits around and says, you know, at some point we're going to have to fight the United States of America, because they're not going to stop destabilizing these nations. They're not going to stop lying to the world. And that, you know, if you get him in that mindset, then sooner or later we're going to have this situation come about. What do you think about that?
So here's the thing about Putin. He's not a dictator. People call him a dictator. He's not a dictator. You know, I follow this, the writings of a professor, Stephen F. Cohen. And obviously Cohen, it's a Jewish name, but I've been reading him for the past 30 years, and he has he's on the John Batchelor show every Tuesday night. He's on for about 40 minutes every Tuesday night, and he's been talking about this for the past few years, ever since the United States overthrew the government in Ukraine and set up basically a Zionist regime in Ukraine. And he has been on the right side of these issues alone. I mean, none of the rest of the academic establishment, they've all been wrong about Russia for the past 30 years, and he's been right about it. And he has been, you know, he doesn't endorse political candidates, presidential candidates. That's not what he does. But he has been pointing out from summer of 2015, that Donald Trump is the only person in American politics that is saying we can get along with Russia. Why should we be rattling sabers with Russia? And he's right. I bring up Professor Cohen. Professor Cohen says Putin is the decider. He's not the dictator. He's the decider. And this is a term that George Bush the second used regarding himself. He's the decider. There are, couple dozen people in Russia who are very important, and Putin can't always get his way. And Putin, just as an example, a month or so ago, he was trying to push a privatization bill through the parliament, and he didn't get his way. He's not a dictator. He doesn't always get his way. Now, there are people high up in the Russian establishment who think war with America is inevitable, and this is very alarming. Putin is not the hawk. Putin is somebody who has much more restraint, and sometimes Putin, at least indirectly, comes under criticism from elements of the Russian elite, and even in the Russian press, comes under criticism indirectly for being too accommodating with the West. And when I say indirectly, he's not being directly criticized, but his foreign minister, Lavrov, will be criticized for making deals with Kerry, you know, making a ceasefire with Kerry in Syria. And then, of course, what happens? The American Air Force shoots bombs Syrian army. And it's a stab in the back. It was intentional. And people are saying, look, Lavrov, he's too trusting of the Americans. Well, when you say Lavrov is too trusting of the Americans, Lavrov is Putin's foreign minister. It's an indirect criticism of Putin. Putin's position's not in danger. He's very popular in the country. But the point I'm making is there are large sections of the Russian elite that really think war with America is coming. And you mentioned the mobilization of reservists. There was the announcement, an advisory from the Russian government that overseas students who are Russian students studying in Europe, that they come back to Russia because they're worried of war. There's a lot of things that they're doing which you could look at as being preparation for war. And it's not a war that they're intending to start. It's a war that they are worried the Americans are going to launch on them.
Absolutely. I think Putin sees, and this is just my opinion, but that a Hillary Clinton will be an unstable person to have as president of the United States of America, especially with regards to how destabilized and the problems that we are facing in the Middle East. I mean, he has to hope that we get some common sense for once in the White House, and that maybe Donald Trump is it. I mean, he has to. I feel certain that that's what he would do, because every way we look at the demographic changes we're going through here in the United States, with the plans that Hillary Clinton has announced she wants to do, which is pretty much Angela Merkel-like, what we see happening in Europe and some of the videos that's coming out of France now and Germany, it's just unbelievable. I think there is a sense of urgency in the American people, and that's why we see these Donald Trump rallies. It's just so phenomenal And hopefully the bias of the media. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, as I'm sure you well saw, the media was declaring Hillary had already won, where you could still point your finger to a lot of polls that were within the margin of error. And you know, it is just propaganda. They're propagandizing the entire public to think that Donald Trump's already lost the race. I hope that the media has lost complete credibility with the American people.
Her corruption and her husband's corruption, the family corruption, makes Clinton so vulnerable. She's so vulnerable. And that vulnerability, I think, makes her very attractive as a puppet for, you know, this Zionist elite, this Jewish elite that I see and I think and more people are seeing really controls or dominates American life. I think this Jewish elite was kind of running a victory lap a year ago or so. I think if you looked at, you know, the gay marriage decision and then the push for transgenderism and the Black Lives Matter and all these things, which are just so anti-white, so anti-Christian, so anti-tradition, American tradition, really anti-American. It seemed as if they thought they could do anything and get away with it. And they were going to have this election and it would be Bush versus Clinton. You know, the two most you talk about a corrupt family. If there's any family that rivals the Clintons, it's the Bushes. And they thought that's what they were going to have. And then Donald Trump just came out of nowhere and they have tried everything to stop him. And he's just kind of like, I guess I'm not a movie aficionado, but maybe the Terminator, where he just keeps scraping back and coming back and coming back. And maybe it was the Terminator too. Everything they throw at him, he just keeps coming back. And they're bothered. They're troubled. They're scared. And, you know, Trump doesn't say anything about Jewish power. And what he says about Israel isn't different from all the Israel shills. But they don't believe him. They don't trust him and they don't believe him. And he's got them completely freaked out. Now, on other issues where it's not quite so taboo, if he's talking about immigration in particular, that is completely against the Jewish agenda, and immigration is a big, high priority in the Jewish agenda. But it's just something that there's not a taboo about talking about it the way there's a taboo about talking about Jewish power. So he's avoiding the taboos, which sooner or later we have to break down. But he is going after really central parts of this Jewish agenda, and he's got them completely freaked out. And a Trump election could very well be revolutionary. I mean, it's not the end of the revolution, but I think probably the beginning of the revolution.
Well, you know, the New World Order speech, as it's been dubbed, the one he gave from West Palm Beach, Florida, a beautiful speech where he was naming a international cabal of bankers that is running America. I mean, he made some statements in that to hear a presidential candidate say, I've never heard before, was jaw-dropping. And of course, he didn't name them outright. But I told a lot of people that were big Trump fans, I was like, if you just listen to that speech and then start Googling, who is the international bankers? Mm-hmm. Who really does own the media? Go find out who owns the Washington Post. Who owns the New York Times? Who owns Viacom, Comcast? Go through and find out who he's really talking about. And you then will know. You then will know who the enemy is, because he said some incredible things in that speech. He all but did name the names. I thought it was incredible. And I wanted to ask you, and one, you can comment on that. But the other thing is, if they rig this November 8th, or if Donald Trump wins in a landslide, or just wins, either way, Hillary wins, Trump wins, whoever wins, you think we'll be seeing a civil unrest that night?
Yeah, I want to talk about the rigging. The first part of the question, though, I just want to comment on, you can use the term globalist or international bankers. It can be used two ways. It can be used as like a dog whistle, where you're using these terms and your audience knows that you're talking about Jewish power, Jewish elites. Or you can use it as a distraction. And, you know, some people, and I don't particularly want to call out Alex Jones, but Alex Jones for many years, he would be using terms in a way that would kind of distract away from Jewish power. It can go both ways. But when Donald Trump made that speech and didn't just say globalist or international bankers, but he called out basically every aspect of Jewish power because he was talking about international finance. He was talking about globalism. He was talking about the media, and he's been so hard on the media. And it's just kind of an outline. All of these elements, it's like a collage, but you take a step back and you see it's formed the silhouette of international Jewish power. And the Jews, if you look at the Jewish press, you look at many high-profile Jewish journalists, they were calling that speech anti-Semitic. And he didn't say the word Jew once in it, but they were calling it anti-Semitic because they recognize that, yes, those are the elements of Jewish power. And so they know he recognizes it, and of course he would recognize it. He made his fortune in Manhattan real estate. Who were his competitors the whole time? So they're very alarmed at it. Now, regarding rigging.
Hold that thought okay. For me. We're coming up. The ADL, Feinstein at the ADL condemned that speech as anti-Semitic. It was interesting. We're coming up on a break. We'll talk about it on the other side. You're listening to The Alternative Media with Farron, joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. Stay with us. And we're back on The Alternative Media. Farron in the studio, joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. He's going to stay with me after the top of the hour break, and we're going to continue running down some of the news. Then we may take some phone calls next hour, so everyone bear with us. But before we were going to the break, we were talking about a little bit of the vote rigging. And, Doctor, I know you were discussing this on Dr. David Duke's show earlier this week. It's a short segment. We'll talk about it. Then we'll talk about it after the top of the hour. But go ahead with your thoughts, because I think you are on to something that we very well will be seeing in the near future. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways the election and the electoral system are rigged. And I don't want to go into the ones that get talked about. I mean, there's the aspect of the media. There's the aspect of the voting machines, which can't, in a lot of places, the voting machines can't be trusted. There's no way to verify them. There's no way to recount other than pushing the button and getting the same answer twice. They have proprietary software. I want to talk about rigging, really, the election results, because the thing is, constitutionally, the president is not elected on November 8th. The electors to the Electoral College are elected on November 8th. And they will vote then in mid-December. I forgot the exact date, but it's mid-December. I think it's the 20th of December. And the votes are counted by the Congress. It's as soon as they open up the Congress, which is probably January 2nd. I'm not sure what day of the week it falls on. It could be the 2nd or the 3rd. Their first order of business is to count the electoral votes. And if it winds up being a landslide and Trump's got plenty of electoral votes to spare, they're not going to engage in any shenanigans regarding the Electoral College. They'll try to undermine him in other ways. They'll try to, get impeachment proceedings, find something to impeach him on, or just out and out assassinate him. But if it's a close election, and a lot of the scenarios, if it's not a landslide, if it's a close election, some of the scenarios have Trump only, one scenario where he loses Pennsylvania but wins New Hampshire and one of the congressional districts in Maine, he would win by one electoral vote. If he wins by just one or a few electoral votes, all they have to do is get some of these Republican electors not to vote for him. They don't necessarily have to vote for Hillary. They could even vote for Mike Pence. But if Trump does not get 270 electoral votes, and maybe on November 8th they're going to put 270 or 273 up on the screen, but if you can peel off a few of them, get them to vote for Mike Pence, for instance, and he comes up short, 269 electoral votes, then it goes to the House of Representatives. Now, if it's a close election and you can get a couple of them to vote for Hillary, then Hillary's going to be the winner. But if you can peel off a couple, say you get them to vote for Mike Pence, and you get to January and they open up, well, I guess we'll have to take this to the other side of the hour.
All right, hold that thought. We'll talk about it on the other side. Stay with us. You're listening to The Alternative Media with Farron, joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. We're back on The Alternative Media. Farron in the studio, joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. The website, thealternativemedia.com. You can email me, thealternativemedia@yahoo.com. And we've got so much to talk about. And before we got to the top of the hour break, Dr. Slattery was talking about the potential for rigging the vote. And actually, during the break, you were talking a little bit about the history of it. Feel free to go into that, because anyone that's listening to this and thinks that this may not happen or wouldn't happen or couldn't happen, I have never before seen the Republican Party work to undermine their very own candidate at every turn. I mean, so we shouldn't think that this is out of the realm of the possible, because the Republican establishment has proven themselves to be completely unloyal to their very own candidate ever since he really established himself as a front runner. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, so the thing about the Electoral College is, under the Constitution, it's these electors who decide the president. And we've gotten used to thinking of them as just being a technicality, or you know, you win Florida and you get 29 points. It's not like that. There are 29 individuals who then get to cast a ballot. And under the Constitution, they can cast a ballot for whoever they want. Now, some states have tried to implement laws to make them vote for the candidate that they were declared for. And there are some states, a minority of states, who have made it so if they don't cast their vote the right way, that vote becomes invalid. But in most states, it's not. In most states, they might face some sort of fine or some sort of prohibition on ever getting public office. But in most states, they can vote for anybody they want, and under state law. And according to the Constitution, they can vote for anybody that they want. And you have this constantly. It's not at all unusual for electors to just decide, oh, I'm going to vote for somebody else. So 1968, you had an elector from North Carolina, Farron, your state, who decided to vote for George Wallace instead of, I think it was Nixon. Instead of Nixon, he voted for George Wallace. In 1988, you had an elector who was supposed to vote for Michael Dukakis for president and Lloyd Bentsen for vice president. Well, he flipped it. He voted for Lloyd Bentsen for president and Michael Dukakis for vice president. And in the 2000 election, as close as it was, one of the electors from the District of Columbia who was supposed to vote for Al Gore just didn't vote for him, just didn't vote, just left, submitted a blank ballot. I don't know if it was a mistake or not. And so then you look at how are the electors chosen, and it varies from state to state. But I know in some states, because I had the experience of being nominated at a state convention, at a party convention, to be an elector, a Democratic elector. I was nominated. I withdrew my name from nomination. This was decades ago. But the person who won was just some guy who had some people in the party knew him, but he, you know, wasn't an elite person. He was just somebody that he wanted the honor, and they gave him the honor. And he was selected long before the nominee of the party was selected. So these people aren't necessarily any more loyal to Donald Trump than the delegates in many states who were supposed to be Trump delegates, but weren't really loyal to him. And as you recall, last summer, there was a lot of talk about trying to thwart Trump's nomination by, you know, bribing the delegates. So the idea that you could get a few of these Republican establishment people, and you know how the Republican establishment has been against Trump, some of these establishment people are the electors. And it's very plausible that you could get some of them not to vote for Trump. Maybe not vote for Hillary, although if it's close enough, that's a risk. But vote for Mike Pence, okay? There's historical precedence for it. Then what happens? In January, when they open up the ballot boxes and count the votes in Congress, you would have maybe 269 votes for Trump and 267 votes for Hillary and 3 or 4 votes for Mike Pence. Well, what happens? Under the Constitution, the House of Representatives then chooses from the top 3 vote-getters. They can choose any one of the top 3 vote-getters. And if Mike Pence only got one vote, he would be one of those top 3 vote-getters. Then the members of the House of Representatives vote, but they don't vote as individuals. They caucus in their states. And if the majority of the 52 congressmen in California, if the majority of them want Hillary, then Hillary gets one vote, one state vote. And if the one person who represents Delaware or Wyoming, the one person who represents Wyoming wants Trump, then that's one vote for Trump, and it's state by state. And I couldn't tell you how that's going to play out, because we don't know what's the composition of the Congress is going to be. But you could, in the past, you have had this happen twice where nobody got the majority of electors. That was 1800, when Thomas Jefferson was intended to be the president, and Aaron Burr was intended to be the vice president, but at under the system that was in effect at that point, they didn't differentiate between votes for the president and the vice president. They both wound up with 73 votes. It took weeks and weeks to negotiate Jefferson winding up being president as intended. You had the same thing in 1824 where nobody had a majority. You had a four-person race, and you wound up having for weeks this struggle between Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams. And Quincy Adams, even though he had less electoral votes than Jackson, was finally elected president. And then in 1876, you had disputed electors. You had rival sets of electors sent by some of the states. And you had, up until the day before the inauguration, you had this business of deciding which of the electors would count. So there's all sorts of things that could happen. And you could wind up with some sort of deal where potentially Pence is president, and then vice president might be Kaine. You know, there's all sorts of things that could happen. And so don't be surprised if it's a close election that you start hearing about these weird scenarios. It wouldn't even be over if CNN and Fox News declare Trump the victor on November 8th. It's not necessarily going to be over.
Wow, that is really interesting.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we had a recent example of the 2000 election, which people remember, and that took over a month before that got resolved to the extent it did get resolved.
So really what that tells me is we don't know until we really know. I mean, until we get through the election and then maybe at least a few days or a week to see how close it was, how this thing's going to shake out. It's got a lot of different scenarios. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump wins or Hillary Clinton wins. You think November 8th and probably 9th and 10th we'll be seeing civil unrest in various parts of the country?
It's not impossible. It's not as if Trump is the type of person who is going to lead an army into Washington, D.C. and you know, overthrow the government. That's not the type of thing I expect. But you use the word civil unrest, and not necessarily on November 9th, but if it looks like Trump, you know, if Trump gets declared the winner on November 8th or November 9th by the news media, and then you have some of the things that I'm talking about. And there's other things that could happen that I haven't mentioned yet, that would be legal and constitutional, but completely outside the realm of what everybody has understood the American elections to mean. Yeah, then you could have civil unrest if they start trying to peel off electors. Or another thing that could happen, and that almost happened in 2000, would be a state deciding to nullify or not to use the electors who were elected on November 8th, and instead have the state legislature appoint their own set of electors. And a state legislature could do it. And a state legislature was going to do it. The Florida state legislature in 2000 was on the verge of doing that. Because, as you recall, they were having all these recounts, and the legislature was controlled by Republicans who wanted Bush. And they said, look, if this isn't resolved by Friday or by Monday, I guess they said by Monday, we are going to send our own set of electors. It would have been an outrage. It would have been completely constitutional. It would have been legal and constitutional, more legal and constitutional than what the Supreme Court did in stepping in. It would have been more legal, but it would have been an outrage because people don't think of our elections as including that. They don't think of our elections as including changing the rules after Election Day, but it could happen.
Wow, that is interesting.
At this point, Farron opened the lines, and we received a call from someone commenting on the problems with the electronic voting machines.
A dozen years ago or so, I remember in my county when they were looking for voting machines. And they had to get voting machines. The old voting machines were basically outlawed by this act of Congress passed after the 2000 election with the butterfly ballot controversies.
Right.
And it was called the Help America Vote Act.
2006. Hillary pushed it through to get elected this election cycle. Yes.
Yeah, the Help America Vote Act. And myself and another professor who was a computer scientist and a few other people, we had gone down to these hearings that they were having at the, you know, the county seat. And we were talking about the various ways that the machines that they were considering would be bad. Now, one type of electronic voting machine that has been used in other countries, which would be appropriate, is a machine that simply prints out your paper ballot. And then you can look at it. And if they've if they've got the right names on there, then you put that paper in the box, and that paper is then what's counted. Right. And that would be great. That would be your paper trail, and it would be voter verified. That's the type of thing that is possible.
I think the real scam that's going on is if you don't have the schematic circuitry, it doesn't matter how proprietary the software is, you can have a Wi-Fi type antenna, and this was done in 2004, I think, in Ohio, and these things cannot be told, because they can basically create temporary code, that, and then basically when they reboot, it disappears. I'm just saying that, so there's no validity of any of the electronic voting machines without the schematics, and this Susan Lindauer on another thing, she was a covert person who had information on Iraq and Syria. And she basically said, after the voting machines are done, you run 10,000 votes on them and see if they do this vote flipping thing. But with the software that we just talked about, they could still do the same thing where they that thing disappears right after they're being used and they go back to their default. But that was a good suggestion. Run 10,000 votes and see if they get 50% on the touchscreen errors. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's my task for you to get Dr. Duke in.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. One thing we wanted to get in before the broadcast ends is just a little bit of, and I've been watching this, and I know you have, but here, and I don't know what kind of time frame, you could, last couple of years or whatever, there has been, Dr. Slattery, just an explosion of new websites, new radio shows, and a lot of these are appealing to the youth, and they're using humor, various forms of humor. Maybe not all of it's for everyone, but I don't care what they're using as long as it's reaching the masses and it's working, so to speak. A Daily Stormer comes to mind. There's Infostormer.com. There's Infowarp.net. These websites, they're making a big impact. And then there's a lot of new radio shows, podcasts. You're doing the National Bugle. I wanted to give you a moment to comment because, and this is my point, I don't think the ADL or any, there's such an explosion, I don't think they can prevent this in any way without, you know, trying to come after the internet and the First Amendment.
Yeah, people have been complaining for many years. Even with the advent of cable TV, you might have 500 choices, but there's nothing to watch. I cancel my cable subscription. I still get CNN because they just give it away. Even though I canceled it, they're just giving it to me. So that's I get to see CNN. But even then, there's nothing. I watch it only to see what they're talking about, not because I'm getting any information from it. And increasingly, I'm finding the only way to get information is to get to go to these types of sites that you've talked about. Now, you know, the internet, which has been around for a little while, has allowed for platforms like RBN and for your show, or for more recently, the past 3 or 4 years, Stormfront Radio and the David Duke Show, which is, I guess, we're wrapping up our fifth year. But now you've mentioned some new websites that are more youth oriented or youth created. So you have Andrew Anglin's Daily Stormer, which has only been around since 2013, and it's such a big deal now, and it's talked about on Capitol Hill in Senate hearings. Hillary Clinton refers to it. And then just last year, you had a podcast called Fash the Nation, another one called The Daily Shoah. And it's a somewhat different format. I guess it's not that different from what we're doing here, but I think younger people listen more to more informal talk. So it's some of these shows are 2 or 3 hours long, and it's the people are just talking and kind of like, well, it's a weekend, we're just having a good time. But what are they talking about? They're talking about this kind of stuff. And you've got some very intelligent people on them. Now, it's funny because a lot of people in the alt-right aren't comfortable using their real names for very legitimate reasons. And so you've got somebody called Jazz Hands McFeels. And there's somebody called Bulbasaur, who Bulbasaur is a Pokemon for those not in the know. And then they have a good time and they're funny. And it appeals to the youth. And Andrew Anglin, he was the person who suggested that I do a podcast. Our generation, we grew up listening to radio, and this format that we have where we're on the air at a particular time and then there's commercial breaks and it's structured, this is very familiar to us. But Andrew Anglin is saying, well, why do you do that? Just have a podcast. And it can be 32 minutes, it can be 56 minutes, it can be whatever, as you know, and it doesn't have to be interrupted. And so that's why when I started this Daily Bugle, I enjoyed guest hosting your show so much, and I wanted to continue So I created this podcast, which we're calling the National Bugle. And it's having a huge impact. And Hillary's alt-right speech, this is what set it off. It's having a huge impact. And I certainly hope Donald Trump gets elected. And if he does get elected, you know, there's a future for it. But if he's not elected, it's so clear that the media was at the heart of the rigging of the election. And people are going to be turning away from the media a lot more than they're turning away from the NFL. I mean, if you think people are turning away from the NFL because of Colin Kaepernick and the Black Lives Matter stuff, oh, just wait to see how people turn away from the media if this election is stolen. And they're going to be turning to, you know, some people will be turning to established shows like you have, but this new format, this new media, and is going to be huge. But, you know, there's also more of an integration, because I've listened to some of these podcasts from Fascination or The Daily Show, and there's a common narrative. All of these different sources, whether it's your show, RBN, David Duke's show, these new shows, we're creating this new narrative, and it's really having an impact. And I don't know if Donald Trump himself or if people are necessarily listening to these new shows or our shows directly, but our narrative is getting in there. It really is. It's having a big impact. And that's only going to grow.
And you know, another aspect of this is the meme, the way people are creating and using these memes as a form of humor, but also exposing the hypocrisy. And of course, here in America, we're fortunate about the worst thing that can happen to you is maybe Mark Zuckerberg suspend your Facebook account or whatever. Which to me, you know, that's a your free speech is just violated in so many different ways. Last week, I was actually sharing, Doctor, there's a gentleman here in this county, a young gentleman that was expelled from school for wearing a Confederate flag belt buckle. It's really had a detrimental impact on his young life, because he's not been able to finish high school because of it. And that's a freedom of speech issue. And we're seeing the same thing with Facebook, but they're actually the youth and of course older people too, but a lot of the youth, they're embracing memes to expose this hypocrisy, and it's working. It's working that it explodes on Facebook, and they use them in other ways. But also in other countries, just like I try to say as often as possible, Jonathan Bonehill is in prison in Great Britain right now for memes that he used in social media. So that may be something we'll see in the future, but it's really done my heart good to see these shows and the explosion and the effect that they're having, because the more of this there is, the harder it'll ever be to clamp a lid on it.
Yeah, and it's great that the young people are having such a big role in it, because I think of, you know, myself or a lot of other people I know, it took me... There's some aspects that I became aware of earlier, but it really took me decades to become aware of a lot of things, because a lot of information is repressed, a lot of knowledge is repressed. It was probably harder for our generation, and to try to get information meant a trip down to the library, which you say, okay, well, next week I'll go down to the library and look into it. Things can move a lot faster now, and it's great to see a lot of young people becoming aware of issues that took people of our generation years or decades to become aware of. And it may well portend well for the future that things really are going to happen. I think historians are going to look back at 2016 as a really pivotal year. And if it's not pivotal, there's really not going to be much of a future. They're probably, future historians will probably be chipping things into stone or writing on papyrus, because really, our civilization is going to collapse. We're not going to be able to maintain a highly advanced technological civilization if things keep going the same way they are. I mean, I was just gonna say, even though technology, we're riding on this tidal wave of technology, which seems like it has no end, but if we have wars, we can't maintain this. We're not going to be able to maintain cell phones, these smartphones, when the machines that create the chips, or the machines that create the chips, there's only a few places in the world. You know, if you have a war between North and South Korea and Samsung's facilities are demolished, it's going to be a major setback. If you have war between Russia and America, you can just set things back by decades or by centuries. And then, of course, if you have the demographic replacement of white people in our country or white people in Europe with Africans and Middle Easterners, that's going to be a setback. I think our audience is mature enough to be able to agree to that.
That's some excellent points. Do you think and I've often thought this, I've never asked anyone this, is the goal of the elite that are in the power structure of the world, is their goal world mongrelization? Is that your goal?
You could certainly make that argument. In whether it's going to be homogenization to some to cream and coffee colored homogenized society, or more of a tossed salad, that's another analogy where, you know, you've got little bits of carrot and little bits of radish and little bits of lettuce everywhere, all mixed up together, and you know they might bleed into each other to an extent, but
we're coming up on a break. We'll wrap it up on the other side. You're listening to The Alternative Media, joined by Dr. Patrick Slattery. Back in a moment. Baron in the studio, it's a pleasure always to have you join me, Dr. Slattery. I mean, you're just so insightful in so many different directions. And we've got about 4 minutes to wrap it up. I guess one of the most important things, everyone should go out and vote, because really, you made a great point during the break. Go ahead and make that point that the more people vote, the better, because...
Yeah, well, it's the more we vote, the harder it is to rig. A lot of their means for rigging are just around the margins. The more we vote, the harder it is for them to rig it.
I agree. And it's, you know, like you said earlier, we're at such a pivotal point. I mean, I've got children, I've got grandchildren, and we are handing off a lower living standard. We're in decline in so many different ways. And I believe this is whether you like Donald Trump or dislike him or love him, this is our last chance to really make a real difference. Because answer this one, Dr. Slattery, if Hillary goes in and changes the demographics and amnesty, it's over. We're never going to vote Donald Trump or anyone else in that's going to affect change.
No. It's be really hard. Every election cycle, it gets harder. And, you know, when you think about it, it's like... I'm starting to get pretty embittered, okay? And the Black Lives Matter stuff has really, really turned me off. But traditionally, through most of my life, I've came from this kind of more of a liberal or progressive background, and I cared about other people. And if you're looking at it from that point of view, how is this Black Lives Matter stuff helping the blacks, okay? How is it making them adopt this fantasy that they're oppressed? They benefit marvelously from being a minority in a white country. They benefit marvelously. They have their cell phones and their cars, and they don't have to worry about food or shelter. They have very nice shelter for the most part. They live fabulously. And honestly, if you look at the balance sheet of slavery, black people who are alive today have benefited tremendously from their slave ancestors. Tremendously. There's this massive infusion of resources from the white community to the black community. And if whites who are sympathetic to them and have really been very good to them for most of the history, I'm not talking about even slavery per se, and certainly not bringing the slaves over, but that was more the Jews than the Europeans anyway. But no, the blacks of our lifetime and recent generations have really benefited tremendously. And how do they do when they're left in all black ghettos like Detroit? If in all black countries like Haiti or Africa, they do terribly. The Mexicans who are coming here, they're trying to get away from Mexico. You know, I have lived overseas, and the last thing, when I lived in Korea or Japan, the last thing I wanted was to have a whole bunch of Americans come over. I didn't want to change the country I was going to. And traditionally, a lot of immigrants who came over, Italians or Ukrainians, they didn't want to change America. They wanted to become Americans. And it was
so- we're out of time, sir. Hey, thank you so much. I'll be in touch with you, and if there's anything I can do for you, let me know, and I'll be joining Dr. Duke on Monday.
Thank you so much. We're looking forward to having you.
Well, that wraps up this podcast. Join us soon for another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. Oh!
Yeah.